the title of this presentation tonight is How Life Was Organized in Babylon, Polytheism and Society. This is another way of approaching the question of divine and human relationships in Babylon in the 6th century BC. Last time, you remember, we looked at king names and looked particularly at those elements in them which are the subjects of the sentences which they represent. And most of them had as the subject the name of a deity: Shamash, Nabu, Adad, Ishtar, and a variety of others. Very few of them, we saw, were without a god name. Those names are called theophoric names which bear the name of a god. And the important thing to remember from what we did the other night is that in those names, given at birth or at the time when someone comes to the throne, as some significant person, perhaps in a ritual of some type, is the relationship to the deity. Tonight, we're going to look at the question of relationships to deity in another way with another body of evidence. Last time we were dealing mostly with written evidence because those names come out of the texts which have been discovered, eventually deciphered, translated, and studied from Sumerian, Akkadian, and the other related languages. And one thing I don't think, well, there are probably several things that weren't clear, but one thing that really wasn't clear was to say that those names we started with the Akkadian dynasty beginning in the 2300s BC, which is the first of the Semitic dynasties. That's when the first Semites came into Babylon and took over the Sumerian predecessor civilization, literature, institutions, and all. We could have gone back and started with the Sumerians, but that would have made it even more complicated. And we might then have guessed about who was there before the Sumerians, if it was a different group. I say that to remind us as we go at the task tonight, that many of the things which are said about deities, many of the names given, many of the descriptions of them that we'll run into, whether in writing or in art presentation, are elusive because they come from a period prior to the historical period when we have sufficient records to trace them. Now, tonight what we're going to do is look at artistic materials. Some people would say we're being more archaeological tonight because we're not dealing with written documents. But since all our written documents, virtually all our written documents from Mesopotamia are recovered by archaeology, I don't think that distinction is a useful one. We're going to be selective again, one has to be, and what we're headed toward is backing up again and starting, in this case, around 2100 BC with a stele of a king named Urunamu, who was deified at that time. Look at the concept of the city in Babylon, because this is a critical concept for understanding Mesopotamian civilization. There is no way to talk about Mesopotamian civilization apart from the long-standing existence of organized communities known as cities. And since the word civilization and the word city are so closely related, that ought to be one, something to hang on to. Now, one of the critical questions about a city is the question of belonging. To whom does the city belong? Who belongs to the city? In answering that question, we have to focus our attention upon the temple and the palace, the gods and the king. Because critical to the answer to that question of to whom the city belongs and who belongs to the city is the fact that at the heart of the cities, conceptually, this is a schematic, this is not an outline of an actual city plan. That's why I put it in diamond shape, so you wouldn't think it was some actual city plan. Although, I forget which city it was, but there's one at least that was laid out on kind of diamond shape. But the relationship between the gods and the kings is critical to the definition of the city, to the existence of the city, and then to what it means to be a citizen, and how the city is organized. We probably won't get to filling this out tonight. Wednesday night we will deal with it when we're dealing with Marduk and his city, Babylon, particularly in the 6th century B.C. But that's the way we're going to approach tonight, through artistic resources, with particularly the question, who were the gods, who were the kings, what were their relationships? How can we characterize that in order to talk about the city, to whom it belongs and who belongs to it? When one deals with this, as with many other things archaeological, I think it is helpful to have an analogy in mind. I don't know of a single dramatic production that works this way. But imagine a dramatic production where the entire theater is in darkness, including all the stage. And the way in which the drama is carried out is only by spotlights, which now hit this part of the stage and these characters. And just as that story moves to a place where you begin to think you know what's going on, the light turns off and the spotlight's somewhere else. And you deal with some other characters, some other personages, and some different action. And then it goes like that. Well, archaeological reconstruction of this type is very much like that. It's discontinuous, it's random, but it does. The other side of it is that we do have very good light on some parts of the story. Now, one of the things we do with that, of course, is to exercise the disciplines of interpolation and extrapolation, and I put them up here in schematic form so that you'll know at least a little bit about what I think we're doing. And interpolation means that you have evidence of a particular type that lines up fairly well in poles. And then you have a gap, and then you have some more poles that are lined up, and you work from the two lineups to extrapolate, to interpolate what is missing. You put it between the poles, you interpolate it. Extrapolation is the other type of thing where you've got some things lined up that seem to move in a given direction. But at the very point that you're primarily interested in, you don't have it. And you extrapolate, you draw from the poles that you have to describe the situation that you're interested in order to be able to say anything about it. Now that means, of course, that you always have the right to say, are you really moving from the evidence that you've got? Are you being controlled by it? Have you gone beyond it? Are you, quote, in line with it? Because pollation means, of course, to be in line with what we've got as we try to speculate about what we don't have. Now, this is particularly important in talking about the temple in the 6th century BC because we have precious little documentary information about it. We have archaeological data about structure. We don't have some of the documents we need to answer the question. The closest we can come is to reason in these two ways about it. And the same is true many times for the king. But if one wanted to say, of whom is this true all the time, it would have to do with the bulk of the citizenry, with the common people and the public. And so that's where we're going to operate. All righty. That's fine, that's fine. Leave that on. That's fine. Now, what I would like you to do tonight is to relax and look at pictures and reflect on them and try to get into them. And ask yourself particularly the question which we're asking tonight. What do these artistic productions tell us about the gods, the kings, and about their relations? Now let me get started by talking about this one a little bit. This is a huge stele. It's 10 feet tall and about 5 feet wide. Comes from around 2100 BC. And relates to a king presented here by the name of Urnammu, and tells the story of Urnammu's construction of a temple for this deity. And I have a close-up of this scene right here that we'll look at in a few minutes. For the present, I want to start from the top and make some general observations about this side of the stele, and then mention also what's on the other side. I wasn't able to find a picture of the other side, but we do have a description of it that is useful. Now, in order to answer some of the questions we're asking, I think some of these subsidiary questions would be useful as you do your reflecting and responding. What do they look like? What is their posture? How are they placed in relationship to each other? What gestures are they making? What about their clothing? What other features presentation are there? Now, let me try a run through of a few things, and then I'm really going to ask you to get in on this and ask or observe about what you see. One of the things that is striking about this particular stele and others that we will look at tonight is the topmost feature. We have a crescent moon, much more than the normal crescent that you see at the beginning of the new moon, and not canted to one side as it usually is when we first see it, but almost, excuse the expression, like a boat with upended prow and stern. This symbol we know to be the symbol for the moon god, a god, not a goddess, who is represented from very early times and is a dominant feature of the Mesopotamian pantheon from the earliest times we can trace to the last time we can talk about. Just to give you an example, as far down as, for instance, Palmyra, when Palmyra was flourishing up in Syria, one of the chief deities of their pantheon was the moon god. Not under the same name as the names used in Mesopotamia, one of which was Nanna, with three N's in it. Another, Sin, S-I-N, which we used last time and talked about in some name, and Nabu, the accent on the second syllable, Nabu. Now, ask yourself, what does it mean that in art, placed at the very top of the picture, we have a representation of the moon, and to the best of my knowledge, never a full moon. Always a crescent, always the bottom part of the crescent, not the top, at, which comes, you know, at the end of the moon's phases, at the end of the 29-day changes that the moon makes. What does it mean that they chose to represent the moon in terms of the initially appearing crescent shape? I don't think it meant they had croissants for breakfast. That we can rule that out, okay? Now, inside the crescent, with this knob and the circle, and then pointed six points, and with then these kind of rectangular radials between the 6 points, is a symbol of the sun god. And the sun god is another persistent member of the pantheon from early times to late times, under the name Utu and Shamash. Now, Shamash is a Semitic name, and so is Nabu. The others probably Sumerian or earlier names, if there was an earlier language. Now, what does it mean that they represented the sun as a star with a knob in the center and a circle and these protrusions between the points of the star? One of the things that we'll refer to again as we move along is that in Mesopotamian theology, the sun, as you see it here, was the sun, S-O-N, of the moon god. I don't imagine that modern-day polytheists, there are any, would ever make the move in that direction, to make the sun secondary in significant respects to the moon. But they did it, and this feature which you see here, you're going to see this tonight a dozen times.
You said the sun of the sun god.
The sun god is represented as the son of the moon god, but the differentiation between the sun and the sun god is not a differentiation they would make because it's personified. We would undoubtedly do it in a different way if we were setting out to be polytheists. Now, these are the two brightest bodies in the Earth's heavens. We'll come along after a while to Ishtar, who represents Venus, the third brightest of the heavenly bodies. The fact that these occur at the top of these steles and in many other presentations underlines the fact that in Mesopotamian theology they were dominant and regarded as such. Now, why might bodies like that be regarded as dominant? repetition of the day and the night, obviously.
What about calendaric?
See here. If you go by the lunar calendar of 29 and a half days, you have a calendar which, like the Muslim calendar, shifts so that the beginning of the year is not always at the same time of the seasonal year. But if you construct a calendar that's a combination of the two, as many of our calendars are, you harmonize the two cycles of the 364 and a quarter days of the sun, its relationship to Earth, and the 354 or 55. Is that 300? Yeah. Of the moon. Now, this scene right here that is partially broken is an enlargement of the scene which we have here and we'll focus on shortly. What is noticeable about it? One, the kind of stool on which the deity sits. The relationship between these two figures is such, as we will see oftentimes, where this one stands before this one who is sitting. What about their costumes? Are they the same? Do they look the same to you? I know that's a small picture, but we'll look at the other one. David, when we look at the close-up, I want you to tell me what kind of tree that is. It's hard to see in this particular picture, but right above these two is a partial portrait of a goddess. You can tell from her hairdo and other things, with a vase with water pouring out of it. One of the persistent symbols of that Mesopotamian pantheon, it are goddesses and gods who hold globular-shaped vases out of which water pours. Okay, let's look at this register now. These characters in the center, what do they look like to you? I'm going to get you all talking yet. What do they look like to you? They look like these two? Louder.
No.
Why? These look male to me. Do they look male to you, these two? Pardon? No? What about their gestures?
They look like twins.
They look like twins? Yes, they sure do. What are they wearing on their heads? What are they wearing on their bodies? Can you see it? What? I can't hear you. That machine's between you and me.
You're saying that the one next to the tree is wearing a long robe, so the other.
Yes. Are they the same kinds of robe? This guy's got a robe on too, but you notice the design is quite different from this one. Pardon? Okay, we'll show it to you in the other picture. You can see it there. You can see the long, flowing, kind of smooth lines of the... What about their arms? You can see their arms. Yeah, they're like this. And you will notice this posture again. This is called the posture of intercession. And what is understood to be going on is that these two minor deities are interceding with this one on behalf as human. who in this case happens to be a king. Notice that he's wearing a different kind of headdress from this one, who has a crown with four sets of cattle horns on it. It looks like a longhorn who got slammed in the door. These are wearing similar crowns, but only one horn. One complete horn on their heads. This is a mark of deity. These cattle horns from very early times appear right at the beginning as a mark to distinguish deities from humans. Why do you need that? Well, because, and this is a very important matter, it is customary in Babylon, almost without exception, to represent deities only in human form, unless you're referring to their symbols. When they are portrayed, they're portrayed as humans, oftentimes as very large humans. Now let's look at the second picture where you can see better. A little better? Okay, let's take a look at this fellow's attire. What does he have in his left hand? What's the modern Arabic name for that? What does it look like? Pardon? Well, does it? Most sickles have a curved blade, like that. What? Come on, don't, let's speculate a little. What is that? What's it? Don't try to be, what?
Hammer?
Yeah. Looks very much like a hand pick. Looks like something you cut dirt with, dig holes with, or cut wood with. All right, what about this right here? Well, look at the way that's coiled. And then look at all this here. And then this long
fishing pole.
What? Fishing pole? Lifesaver for small people. A rope? It looks something like a rope, doesn't it? Now, the reason I want to call your attention to this is you're going to see a stylized version of this in picture after picture after picture of gods with kings standing in front of them. And what you're always going to see is the god's hand out holding the ring, or the ring and the rod or staff, and never giving it to the king. The king is often looks like he wants it, but it, as far as I know, there's not an example of it changing hands. Maybe, tomorrow morning somebody may find one. This, most of them highly stylized. This is one of the ones that suggests to people that what we've got here is a measuring line. A measuring line used for measuring buildings. What else might be measured? What?
Land.
Land, right. The association with this suggests maybe we're talking about measuring of land. Anything else you think of? Now, let me tell you how that is interpreted abstractly from this base. This is the sun god, who becomes the guardian of justice, the judge of heaven, judge of the gods, the judge of humans, the protector of the poor, particularly the protector of those without rights. And people have suggested that the rod and the ring derived from measuring land, measuring buildings, getting things just the way they're supposed to be, getting things orderly, leads then to this becoming symbolic of justice. Now, I'm not saying that's what I think, because I find that jump a little strange to make. We'll come back to that when we study the god Shama. Now, look at his hairdo, front and back. What do you call that thing? A front?
A bun.
A bun? What's the French word for it? Chignon. Isn't that the chignon? Yeah. Chignon. Now, the reason I point that out is if you want to know how to tell gods from goddesses, you got to look right there. That's male. Also here. What does that beard look like to you?
Woven mats.
It does. It looks woven or braided, doesn't it? All right. Which way is he facing? He's facing the king who's over on the other side of this tree. And he's extending this to him. He's holding this very close to his chest. And notice the similarity between his beard and his cloak. Does that suggest anything to you about what they're trying to represent in this beautiful robe he has on?
Maybe hair?
Probably. Hair. Wool. When was the sheep domesticated in this part of the world? By this time, 4,000 years before. Still a basic source of food and milk and meat. Now, what does this look like here? Looks like a building, doesn't it? One of the things you're going to see later on is pedestals like this that look like the facades of building. And on it, not the figure of the god, but the symbol of the god. Now, this particular stele is the record of Urnamu's construction of a temple for Shamash, for the sun god. What are you selling? All right, down here, the thing has been defaced, but you can see the king here dressed, believe it or not, still in his good clothes, and carrying the tools for construction, being led by a minor goddess, a god, being followed by an assistant. So he's actually portrayed in this register, which is complete, in the process of construction. And then down here, we apparently had some more details of the construction, which involved the use of a ladder. All right, David, what kind of plant is this? Well, wait a minute, let's see if somebody else here. What kind of plant is that?
Palm tree.
One leaf, one branch, one frond, a couple of clusters of dates. Another, a plant that is basic to the economy of Mesopotamia from early times was the date. Now let's think about what kinds of things we can get from. First of all, fruit that can be stored, sugar, wood for construction, palm fronds for roofing. What else?
Shade.
Oh, good. Yeah, we'll think of that word. Yeah? Very good shade. What else? What else? What other resources for life does palm tree offer? It's prolific in Mesopotamia, especially in the south.
Did they use the nut of the roofing?
The fronds, the palm fronds, yeah. They tell me it's young stalks can be eaten like celery. I'm not sure. The chief source of sweetening for most of the history of Mesopotamia down to about 800 BC, when bees were introduced, was the date. Somewhere around 1000 BC, they developed an alcoholic beverage making grapes. Prior to the time, prior to the time of grapes were introduced. A very important plant, but what's the king doing to it? What? Well, he was in the other picture. What was he doing?
Oh, he's watering it?
He's watering it, yeah. Now, put that together. What is being said about the king in relationship, in this case, to the sun god, for whom he's building a temple?
He's taking care of the gift from God.
He's between him and the god is this plant that he's caring for. Suggests an agricultural context for the relationship. All right, anything else you want to ask or say about this particular picture? Go on to the next.
What do you think the serpent is about?
Excuse me?
What do you think the serpent is about?
I don't know. Where it came from. I think what is quite clear, and part of the answer to our question that has come up, is that they are two symbols of domain, of lordship and control, because though they are held up to the human king by the deity, they're never given over. And they seem to be simple. Also, the other thing about them is they're always only in the hands of major deities, never minor ones. And usually fertility and celestial deities. You had a question, Mark?
Is that little crescent that he's sitting on representing the moon?
I don't think so, but it could be. Does that look like a comfortable stool to you?
Yeah.
On the sides?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not cutting off his circulation.
No, that's to hold the letter turned over.
Yeah. One other thing. What about the perspective in this thing? Well, art historians say what we've got here is some indication of the effort to be three-dimensional and to get real perspective, because you have him, his face in profile, but then the beard is flat. The crown is sideways. So the points which met over the forehead, as we'll see in other pictures, are turned to the side so that you get the full view, and you know what is right here. Now, let's back up just one more. If this is all you had to go by in terms of, somebody said, what was the character of Ur-Nammu's relationship to Shamash? What was the relationship 2100 BC between the king of Ur and the sun god? On the basis of that picture, how would you describe the relationship? We've already talked about custody, but what I mean is in terms of the bodily stances and the visual relationship, what kind of relationship is going on? Is Ornamu afraid of Shama? Is Shama's beneficent to Ornamu? Do you have any indications of that? What about, is that an active picture or a static one? Well, if you didn't have this down here, I think you'd say static, but because of the story that goes with this, and the fact that down here you have the acts of construction, and on the other side, let me tell you what's on the other side of it. On the other side of it, the top scene is the same. Partially destroyed here. But below it are the dedication ceremonies for the temple. Plus, Ornamu in the act of digging, guess what he's digging? Canals. Digging canal. That without which you don't grow nothing in Mesopotamia. If you had an air photo of this part of the world, like some of the ones we've got around here, you would see all kinds of lines on it showing the ancient canal system. In order to control the flooding, Euphrates particularly, all kinds of canals were dug, and because of the problem of salinization, they had to be moved to another place. And when I think of that picture, the picture I think of from recent experience is driving through Holland, where they reclaim land from the sea by building dikes around it, and then draining the water out into channels, letting it sit for 15 years until the salinization is reduced, and then it can grow. Now, Mesopotamia is not the same, it's the reverse problem. But it's also responsible for the salinization problem and the fact of irrigation as a basic form of royal activity, of deity domain, control of the land and use of the land. It's also responsible for the fact that barley is the primary cereal grain because it can tolerate higher degrees of saline water than wheat can. And it is the dominant one. What do you say about the relationship? I want you to say something about what that would say to you about divine-human relations as portrayed here. Is he bigger or smaller?
Delegation.
Is delegation involved? What do you make of the fact that they're both represented in human form? Does that talk about affiliation, kinship? Yes, that's, I have a record that says that at home. I have a Bible that says something different, but a record that says that. However you come about that, though they are different in dress, different in stance, they are both represented as males and as humans, one much larger than the other. Okay. The king, the god is much larger. If you stood him up, he'd be much bigger than him.
I'd rather stood him.
Huh? Okay, we've looked at that enough. Let's look at it a minute. This is a picture of the ziggurat at Ur. These ziggurats are important not only because of the number of them in ancient Mesopotamia and all, but the names. The names refer to the fact that these are mountains which provide a meeting place between heaven and earth and the under earth, the underworld. This is a reconstruction of it, with stairway going up from here. And most of the reconstructions you will see are derived from this one or the one at Susa in Persia, with the hypothesis that at the top there was a temple such as Unani was being commissioned to build for Shama. Now, let's look at this one. This is one of the most famous artifacts from Babylonia, even though it wasn't found in Babylon. It had been taken away to Susa by Elamites when they had conquered Babylon, but it is a portrayal of whom? Do you remember who this is? This is the great Hammurabi. So we've moved down now into the 1700s. It's about 400 years. And this again is the god Shamash. One of the indicative features that would put that beyond doubt are these rays emanating from his shoulders, which are related to the rays that were between the points of the solar star in the preceding picture. Now, I'm going to try to maintain relative silence while you tell me about this picture. Stands, relationship, all that. The rod and the ring. Sitting on the same type of chair, except it didn't have those scallops hanging down here. It didn't have that crescent that Martha was looking at, and the arch is slightly different, but it's a probably a temple facade, which is being provided as Sisi. You know, we usually talk about temples as the houses of the gods, and in fact, their names are that. But when the facades are used in these portrayals, they are not the houses, they're the pedestals or the chairs. I wonder if we need to change our terminology about that. Can't universalize from one. By the way, this is a tall thing. The one at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia that I was looking at a couple months ago, I couldn't reach the top of it. And from here down is, in PDF form, the Hammurabi Law Code. Let me read you the preface to the Law Code. When Shamash, with radiant face, had joyfully looked upon me, his favorite shepherd, Hammurabi. Then he talks about being called to cause justice to prevail in the land, to destroy the wicked and the evil, that the strong might not oppress the weak. And then he goes on to articulate a law code. All right. What about postures and all the rest?
The god is sitting and the king is standing.
Again?
And he's just, it seems to me that staff might almost be bearing between them.
Interesting that instead of clasping it in his hand, he's got his fingers open as though he's offering it. But it isn't taken. It's not reaching toward it. Look at how that left hand is folding all the folds of the robe. Have you ever seen such beautiful artwork? It's showing, this is in diorite,
Look at the beautiful flow of that. I wish you could see his feet. They're very realistic looking feet. So were the God's feet. What else?
His hand be open because he's listening to the king.
Okay. This particular posture with one arm down and one arm up is usually defined as a posture of prayer. And what I think we're supposed to hear when we look at this is the king praying to the God. Nobody between them. Not much distance between them, although that may be a function of the material he's working with. But we saw it on a much broader piece of material. This is only about 2 feet wide at the top up at this point.
That's not the Hammurabi code.
Right.
Couldn't it just be, that would be so complicated. Why couldn't it just be simple enough to think that Hammurabi is showing whoever sees this, that his code is there, it's just, it's being blessed by the God.
Yeah, it's probably one of
them. Whatever. You know, but he's saying, look, it's not just me, it's the God who's saying this in Christ.
Okay. But I find that really complicated, even though I know what you're pleading for. Putting it up at the top and putting that relationship on it and putting the code beneath it says, he ordered me, or he commissioned me, he blessed me. What does that tell us about the relationship between this God, for instance, and the people affected by the law code? Who are you, the king? The king is the agent, and not an unwilling agent. You know, there's nothing in that picture to suggest that he's doing this under compulsion.
I don't find that unusual. I guess based on what we know about other religions that we have today, when the ruler is doing what the God has told them, what their God has told them, and they just passing on the right word, what to do.
Right. Another thing to be said about this is that while most people can see the picture and look at it, and even strangers like us can look at it and begin to think about it, we're like the ancient people in whose site this was erected. We can't read the Akkadian cuneiform. But we're told who generated this. What about the beard on the king and the beard on... Again, we have anthropomorphic. We have gods represented in human form. And we have the human reflecting, but not equaling, the representation of the deity. What about this beard here?
Yeah, isn't it funny looking?
Suggestion is that we've got another attempt here at getting three dimensions. If they have at least tilted it and made you think that it's around front. Notice the horns are no longer turned to the sides. We see the horns, but they're represented in profile. I don't think you can see the sun disk up at the top of his hat very well, but it's there. The hats are different. This is a typical Sumerian type woolen cap that he's got on. Anything else?
Is there any significance in the fact that the gods never touch the ground?
What are they touching?
It looks like a pillow or a little
It does look.
And yeah. The other one had the same shoe.
The other one had these upside down on here, I think. This is a stylized mountain. Because we'll see later when we come back to Shamash, whenever we come back to him according to the schedule, that he is represented as rising between and coming up above the mountains in the east. It's part of the description. Anything else about it?
The layer of stars that appears in the sky.
That's this?
The tear the skirt.
The skirt, red. Oh yes.
Do they only show up on God's
day? No.
Or is that Sumerian customary?
Well, this is a Semitic period. And it's one of the distinctions that they make between humans and the deities. But they will come up. We'll see it again. Okay. Now, those two representations are clearly anthropomorphic, in which the deity is being presented as somehow kin to the humans and greater than, but in relationship to them. We also have a very early tradition which is reflected on these standing stones, which are usually placed out in the second, third zone of the city area, the farmlands, and mark grants of land which the king has made to individuals or to officials. And then these are placed there with an inscription warning people against moving them and violating them and not regarding the grant as official. Under, as we had it before, as B was pointing out, under the aegis of a variety of deities. Now, we're not going to go into all these symbols tonight, but the reason I put this in here is to remind us that though it is clear, it will become even clearer, that in 6th century Babylon there were four dominant deities, three of whom are celestial. Ishtar, the eight-pointed star, Nabu, the crescent moon, and Shamash, the sun, that there are also a variety of other deities whose characteristic symbols are represented here. And a person familiar with the mythology, familiar with the stories, the poems, and the songs, would see that marker in the land and say, I better not move that, I'll be in trouble with everybody. With all these powerful figures, the high gods of the heavens, the gods who wear these multi-tiered caps, storm god, gods whose scepters are like lions, gods who subdue dragons. Now, this one I got again. This one, by the way, comes from 1300s and 1100s BC. We're moving down. Here's another presentation of a couple of those. Pick this out for this particular scene in which the god with a feathered crown. Now, this feathered crown is usually traced to the influence of the people called the Kassites, who is enthroned on a little stool, and now it's on a pedestal. And this king is bringing his daughter. And I want to include that because the king's daughter is very important in this scene. And this particular type of scene is called presentation scene. What's interesting about this one to me, after looking at an awful lot of them, is that a human is presenting another human to the deity. Notice the deity's hands. What would you make of the hand gesture that you see there? Anything particular?
His blessing.
Almost, isn't it? It's just a kind of beneficent gesture. There's the prayer gesture again. And here's a human introducing another human, his daughter, to the king under the aegis. And notice the whole relationship, whatever it is, and in this case it involves a land grant which the king is making to his daughter, is under the aegis of the celestial deities, plural. most presentation scenes involve a deity, a minor deity, not as much crown and all the rest, presenting the king to the high god. So the number of deities is increasing. Here's another early boundary marker with the king, with his armaments for war, in his uniform, in which he begins to look as almost as impressive as one of the gods, with his grand land again under the aegis of the high gods, at least one of whom is represented as turtle and chicken. Can you imagine having a chicken one? Don't laugh at that. Now, I'm going to conclude with this one tonight. Polytheism. Probably a very poor term to use, but you can come up with a better one. I'll be glad to use it. This carving out of live rock, which comes from a period we're not sure of, but it seems to be from the Assyrian period because of the artistic traditions involved, shows the Assyrian king at either end of a procession of several deities, all of whom are standing except this one, all of whom have the ring in hand, except that one. Most of whom have rod along with the ring. Some of whom have other symbols. This one with a beneficent look, and these two with something that looks like a whip or a tassel. Here, this god with lightning bolts, riding on composite animal, lion, cattle, composite animal, horse, etc. Notice the seven-horned crown of this deity and this one, and then down to five along here. Most of them have the round disc on the top, which represents sun god, except this one is conical right here. Notice the conical hat on the king. Now, I want to leave you with an impression tonight. We've moved along, skipping and jumping. Who's the tallest figure in that picture? If you took the animals out from under the deities, who would be the tallest one in the picture? Well, you'd have to measure, wouldn't you? Because it's so close. And one of the tendencies that comes up during the Assyrian period is an erasing of that distinction which we saw between the deity and the human in the earlier ones in size, dress, notice the dress, beard, hairstyle. During the Assyrian period, there's a much closer equation between the figure of the king and the figure of the deity. And one thing we know about the Assyrian kings was that they understood themselves not only to be the political and military leader of the community, but also the high priest of the god Ashur, who is one of the figures here. And we have, in addition to it, two Ishtars, and storm god, and sun god, and a bunch of others. The Assyrian king is before and after it, with his mace in his hand as a symbol of his royal leadership. These high gods all are symbolized as the ones with the rod and the ring of domain and power. This comes from up north of Assyria. And the period it comes from is not for sure, but its artistic tradition is very sure. Ishtar is often associated with the lion, storm god with the bull, Marduk and Ashur, who get confused with each other and merge with sun god, with a composite type of animal that we'll look more closely at later on. Storm god here with lightning bolts.